Okay, we're going to get started. I'm Tarek El-Rafi. I am the Division Chief for Hematology and Oncology, and this is the July lecture. January, we have the fellows. We have new fellows in January and July. So we usually give the emergency series of lectures during the first months of residency. Now, the emergency series will be divided into hematologic and oncologic emergencies. So today I'm going to handle the first four bullets, which is the benign hematology emergencies. And then the other stuff, which are more oncologic, either hematologic oncology or solid tumor stuff, will be handled by Dr. Alexis in the next month. So today I'm going to be talking about sickle cell disease, management of transfusion reactions, TTP, and DIC. So the first topic is sickle cell disease, and some of the questions that have come up in past years, either on rounds or with actual patients, are what type of sickle cell disease patients can have an acute chest syndrome. ACS is acute chest syndrome. Are there any laboratory tests that can screen for this? And what's the best treatment modality for this? Do we do an exchange transfusion or do we just do a simple transfusion? And we'll go through the criteria for some of that. So we have more than one phenotype for sickle cell disease, right? We have SS disease, but we also have SC and sickle beta thalassemia too. And all three of them can have complications, the same complications, where you may see preponderance of more than one for one subtype. SS is certainly the most common. You have more pulmonary hypertension with that. SC disease, you tend to get more leg ulcers. They all can have acute chest syndrome. And that's the thing as an intern or a resident for the first time that you need to be aware of, because that is the most life-threatening thing for them. Our most common cause of admission is obviously acute pain crisis, but it is related to acute chest syndrome. They get renal complications, they get sequestration crisis, they can get priapism, and they can have sequestration anywhere. They can get in their liver, their spleen, their lung. So these are all things you need to be aware of, and the treatment is going to be somewhat similar. It's going to be transfusion, it's going to be other supportive care measures, and possibly an exchange transfusion. Remember, an exchange transfusion is not plasmapheresis. Well, I should say plasmapheresis is an exchange transfusion, but in sickle cell patients, we're talking about a red cell exchange. So sometimes people will say, well, we're going to do plasmapheresis. Well, that's when you freeze off the plasma and give them back FFP. In this case, we're freezing off the red cells and giving them a new red cells. But it's all conceptually the same thing. So what is acute chest syndrome? How do we define an acute chest syndrome, right? I would say when you look at an EKG, the answer is not going to just jump out at you. You need to know what you're looking at. What are the criteria for an MI? So everybody can sort of, I'm sure they can rattle that out from, you know, their first days of being a medical student, that the criteria for an acute MI. So do we know what the criteria for acute chest syndrome is? What is it that we are looking for in these patients? And so I took it from, and it wasn't just me, but I took it from the landmark in New England Journal of Medicine article, which came out in June of 2000, referenced below, in which they use in their methods section the criteria for acute chest syndrome is somebody with an infiltrate, and that could be sometimes a pleural effusion, not atelectasis though, an infiltrate and a symptom, either chest pain, cough, tachypnea, or wheezing, and fever greater than 38.5, as well as a drop in hemoglobin of less than 2 grams from baseline, and a platelet count of less than 175,000. So some of our patients actually have high platelet counts. I wouldn't use the platelet count as a criteria per se, but the main thing is infiltrate, some kind of symptom, and fever, right? What does that sound like? That sounds like pneumonia, doesn't it? Right. So Ron Nagel, when he was the chair of the Unified Hematology Division at Monty, he used to say there's no such thing as pneumonia in sickle cell patients. They're sequestering red cells, or it's a different mechanism of action, but it certainly looks a lot like a pneumonia does. So how do we differentiate that? Well, so there was a study looking at this also, actually, and they looked at 600 and something patients prospectively, and they tried to find out what is the cause of the acute chest syndrome in our sickle cell patients. So, ostomy and lavage in some patients, The outcome of the study, even though it was observational, it was prospective, was that exchange transfusion did improve the survival in those patients. And as I mentioned before, the mechanism is different. You have red cells trapped in the alveoli that causes the shadow and the infiltrate, although you can't have white cells as well as you do in pneumonia, but it's radiographically looks similar, okay? So we know it's the most common cause of death in sickle cell patients. It is the second most common cause of hospitalization after uncomplicated vaso-occlusive crisis. It is usually preceded by a painful vaso-occlusive crisis. So, you know, take it seriously. I know there's a lot of patients that, especially in the inpatient setting, you see the ones that come in a lot of times are either drug-seeking or you have certain things you think about those patients. But it truly does follow an acute chest, a painful crisis. So a lot of times they'll actually go home, and then they'll come back with chest pain. They you know, will describe pain in the long bones before, and their back and their legs, and they come back a few days later. Well, they may not be malingering. They may be on their way to an acute chest. So just keep that in mind. It is closely related, temporally related to that. And one of the risk factors for acute chest is that they've had it once before, so important in their history to ask that. Some of them are very knowledgeable about that, and they'll tell you, yes, I was either intubated, or I had an acute chest, or I had an exchange transfusion. They'll be able to tell you that. And we know that repeated episodes of this can lead to pulmonary hypertension, and pulmonary hypertension leads to premature death in sickle cell patients. And you know, interestingly, I just found out myself, been here for many years, just found out last year that we actually have a pulmonologist who has a special interest in this, Dr. Atiyah Abdallah, who you may know. She's the chief of the NCB, but she comes here and rotates here, and she actually comes to the cardiac cath lab and runs a pulmonary hypertension clinic for patients with sickle cell disease. So anybody that we screen either by echocardiogram, although you need truly a cardiac cath to establish the diagnosis, should be referred to her and to her special clinic over here. So what did they find when they looked at the etiology of this? They found 27 different infectious organisms, right, out of 600 patients. So there's not one common thing that can happen. It could be viral, it could be bacterial, it could be atypical bacteria. So it's not something that's always covered for our patients. So something to keep in mind when we are giving antibiotics to cover the atypicals as well. And very important, fat embolism, right? And if you do bronchoalveolar lavage in patients, you'll see evidence of alveolar macrophages, or some people look at serum phospholipase as another mechanism. Urine lipids is another way of looking at this. I'm not sure if that's commercially available right now. But fat embolism is a common mechanism, and the other common mechanism is infectious, and that can be viral or bacterial infections. And you can see the list of the many things that were found. Now, 23 to 62% are unknown. That was based on the study where they had all the data that they were asking for. It was down to 23%. But if they only had some of the data, 62%, they did not know the reason for the acute chest. Fat emboli presentation, so the typical triad is they develop some kind of rash, either like a livid or reticularis. They have mental status changes also, in addition to the hypoxemia. Usually there are tiny little infarctions in the bone when someone is having a vaso-occlusive crisis, and that's what will lead to the fat embolization. And then those fat emboli travel to the lung within a day or two. And usually this is associated with chest pain as well. So is there a reliable screening test that we can use to say that, aha, here's the magic blood test. We are going to predict that this patient has an acute chest syndrome and maybe keep an eye on them a little closer, or maybe move quicker to an exchange or a simple transfusion, treat them with antibiotics earlier. So serum phospholipase A2 is one of the surrogate markers. It's an inflammatory mediator, not readily available to measure, but somebody has correlated levels of serum phospholipase A2 with the onset of an acute chest syndrome. So the conclusion from this blood article many years ago was that, yes, this is something that may be able to predict future acute chest syndrome. So can we get that readily? No. But C-reactive protein, which is also the parallel marker for many other disease states, including cardiovascular events and other hematologic conditions, inflammatory marker, is something that sort of runs in parallel with serophospholipase A2, and here's this graph depicting that. This was only in 12 patients that they did this, but interesting nonetheless. And a cheap test, readily available, can be added on and checked daily for patients who are coming in for a pain crisis. And just one of the many variables that we as hematologists may use in trying to assess if this patient is on the way to an acute chest syndrome or not. I mean, usually we get these calls and we have to make a decision whether we want to exchange transfusion or not, right? So the treatment is going to be similar to treating a pain crisis, and then you use analgesics. It'll have the addition of using broad spectrum antibiotics to cover one of those 27 organisms, right? So you want to cover atypicals. Incentive spirometry, very important. The reason why, the patients are oftentimes in pain. They're splinting. They can get atelectasis, worsening the hypoxemia, and therefore worsening the sickling and the vasoocclusion. So bedside spirometry is a simple thing that we ask them to do all the time. And then we have to decide versus simple exchange transfusion. What's the difference? Simple, you're just ordering a unit or two or three units of blood. And an exchange transfusion, we got to call the blood bank, and we have to do a therapeutic apheresis where we're taking off their blood and we're giving them back all the components except for the red cells and adding packed cells to that, right? So when do we do one versus the other? That often depends on what their hemoglobin count is and what their baseline is. So what should be the normal baseline hemoglobin for a patient with SS disease? Anybody have an idea? Around. Is it 12? No, right? They're usually anemic, right? So where is it usually? Yeah, it's around 8.4 actually in the studies. That's the median number. For SC patients, it's higher. SC patients run a hemoglobin of 10 usually, right? And so we have to just keep that in mind. We don't want to over-transfuse them because that can create a hyperviscosity if they're not used to that and actually worsen the crisis. But also, you know what, if they have a hemoglobin of 6, well, that's easy. We get to just say transfuse and it's not a big deal of doing exchange transfusion. But if they're around that 8, 9 range and they're in and they have the criteria, they have either chest pain or shortness of breath, they have hypoxemia, they have a fever, then guess what? Then for that patient, they're going to be getting an exchange transfusion, right? So those are the criteria. Sometimes we'll just say, well, let's follow the oxygen saturation. That's not one of the criteria, but it's obviously an important endpoint for these patients. So in summary, patients with any of the different phenotypes or genotypes of sickle cell disease, SS, SC, sickle beta thalassemia, can have crisis. It's predominantly a clinical diagnosis, although we can use the C-reactive protein as a surrogate marker, but it's a clinical diagnosis. And remember, it's often preceded by a vaso-occlusive pain crisis. And then exchange transfusion can be life-saving in these patients. Any questions about sickle cell disease before I go on to the next topic?
How high do you want to transfuse? Would that probably?
Yeah, I don't like them to go above 10 if they're SS. If they're SC, then maybe you can go a little bit higher if their baseline is 10. But usually a point above their baseline is reasonable. And you know, if you are doing an exchange, you're never going to get them. We like to do electrophoresis afterwards, right? We like to see, and we like to do it before as well, because if they've had a lot of transfusions and their hemoglobin S level is down to 30%, well, you're not going to get it much better than that, because you know, if you do a whole body exchange, you're never going to get it 100%, right? Because there's always going to be blood in their body. You can't take that. You can't take it out 100%. And put it in 100%. So you're just going to be constantly diluting it. So the yield will be a lot less for patients who have an already low hemoglobin S level. So we'll often ask for that before and after an exchange or even a simple transfusion to see where they are. So it's not just the absolute level, it's also the hemoglobin S level that we follow. Sure.
What about
wasn't on there, right? Yeah, so hydration, and in hydration, you know, the question was in the past, do you give normal saline or half normal saline, right? So the theory is that normal saline will cause more sickling than something which is a hypotonic solution, which will prevent some of the sickling. So, you know, I like half normal saline, but if they're hypoxemic, you know, you have to adjust based on that as well. But yes, hydration is an important component of this. You also have to monitor them, make sure they don't have any cardiac problems and hydrating those. Yes, hydration, oxygen, analgesics, antibiotics, and if necessary, transfusion.
If the patient has a saturation
96,
for example, would you give oxygen?
Now, is there data?
Yes.
So is there evidence based for that or not? I mean, we'll give 1 liter because we don't think it will hurt them that much, and there may be times when whether they're sleeping or splinting, where that level may dip down. You're not doing continuous monitoring, so it's more for that. But you know, if they're 96%, that's usually pretty good, and you wouldn't be so concerned about sickling happening or worsening of the vasoocclusion happening with that. I mean, you know, it's more than one mechanism. Hypoxemia is one of them that can do that. And, you know, if they are a little bit hypoxic, they're going to have a baseline pulmonary hypertension, that vasoocclusion can make things worse. Anything else? Okay. Next thing, transfusion reactions. So this happened to me, I remember, on my second day of internship. I won't forget that, so it's incorporated into the talk. So this covers more than one thing. A transfusion reaction can be infection, can be an immunologic reaction as well, ABL compatibility, could be trolley, acute lung injury. I'll talk about that a little bit. Anaphylactic reaction, or circulatory overload, which was, I think, my second day of internship case. I had circulatory overload from that. So these are different things, and these numbers are important to know when you're consenting the patient, right? We have to consent them when they want to know, and the thing that they're all worried about, number one, is infection, right? They don't want to get HIV, right? So what's the risk of getting HIV from New York Blood Center blood? 1 in 600,000. Not bad, probably like 1990. It's a little bit better now. So here are the risks, right? And this was published in the Journal of Transfusion. And so death is 1 in 100, 200,000, and that could be from some kind of immunologic deficiency or reaction. Acute hemolytic reaction, 1 in 20,000. Hep C virus and HIV. HIV is less than 1 in 1 million. It's about 1 in 2 million in New York, actually. And they check the donors, and they check the bag also before. Sometimes there are patients that are in the window. They haven't developed antibodies yet. And so I think now they're checking viral loads as well. My favorite, though, is the last one, right? Being murdered in Washington, D.C. 1 in 2001. This was actually published. So you tell them you got more of a chance of being murdered in Washington, D.C. than having a reaction to this blood. So just to put it all in perspective for these patients. But these are the different things. I hope that doesn't offend anybody from Washington, D.C. My brother just moved there. I'm worried for him now. So what are the different types of reactions? There are major incompatibility reactions. So these are the ABO AB mismatches, where the recipient plasma and the donor red blood cells have corresponding antigen. You have minor mismatches, which the ABO type is matched up, but there may be smaller or different HLA matches, which can cause a febrile reaction. Nothing very serious. And then you have interdonor reactions. What are the symptoms? Chest tightness, shortness of breath, chills, back pain. For some reason they get back pain. This also happens sometimes with chemo infusion reactions. There's something about an immunologic response that gives you back pain. Hypotension and burning at the IV site. So what do you do? A lot of it is common sense. You stop the transfusion. You start IV fluids to avoid hypotension and shock. If it's later on and they become oliguric, you don't want to overload them, so you may have to actually fluid restrict them. And this statistic is still true somehow, 50% result of clerical errors in matching of the blood, patients moving beds, name tags, and it's on your boards every year, this stuff. Still 50%, maybe it's a little less than that, but that's the most common cause. Other transfusion reactions, IgA deficient individuals. It's interesting, it's only one in 550 people have an IgA deficiency. There was one case during fellowship in which somebody had a platelet transfusion that probably wasn't necessary before an invasive procedure. It was actually liver biopsy. That patient had anaphylaxis and died. So you just have to choose your transfusions carefully. And considering now there is an HHC task force which I'm on, in which they're trying to minimize the number of transfusions. I think with all the HHC hospitals, we gave something like 30 million units of blood. Not just red blood cell plasma platelets, over the 11 HHC hospitals over the course of a year. So they're trying to figure out this. And one of the things we're looking at is safety. I think they're mostly concerned about cost, but safety as well. But there are unnecessary transfusions, so we just want to minimize that. The spread bowel reactions, which can be from bacterial contamination, happens more so with platelets because platelets are stored at room temperature. They're only good for 5 days, so if it's towards the end of that 5-day period, there can be some bacteremia there. And there's also immunologic, which you have HLA antibodies to contaminating donor leukocytes. And that leads us to the next thing. The screening is the same, but the prevalence, I think, is much higher for hepatitis C than it is for HIV. So I would think that's the only reason why. So we're going back to this slide, right? The Hep C virus is 1 in 300,000 versus 1 in 1 million. I mean, these numbers probably need to be updated, but I would think that that would be the reason why. And I'm not sure, I know the window to develop HIV antibodies is in the range of like 3 weeks. Hep C virus may be longer than that also, so there may be a larger window as well. All right, so what do you do after? So you stabilize the patient now. These are the tests that we usually check for. Basically, the tests looking for hemolysis, bilirubin and LDH. Urine hemosiderin as well is a marker of hemolysis. It looks for red blood cell fragments. Serum haptoglobin should go down, right, because it binds to free hemoglobin usually. And just be aware that when you do transfuse somebody, you can get, there are some red cell fragments in there, and you can get some a low haptoglobin anyway, so you can have some false positive results there. Coombs testing and blood typing, but usually the blood bank knows what to do, and they'll be testing the blood product. Next thing I'll talk about is TRALE. So TRALE stands for transfusion-associated acute lung injury. Okay, transfusion-associated acute lung injury. So it's defined as a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema that's related to the transfusion of usually plasma-containing blood products. So it's not, plasma is not just FFP. There's a little bit of plasma still in red cells and in granulocytes. We don't do much granulocyte transfusion, but other blood products as well. The criteria and the mechanism is that you have a pulmonary leukagglutinin reaction. So you have donor antibodies against granulocytes, right? And usually these are a female multiparous donor who develops these antibodies, and then you have a second hit, which is you have these leukocytes that are in the pulmonary vasculature, in the pulmonary alveoli, because the patient in the hospital, they're sick or for they have an infection, and you have the antibodies attack these granulocytes and cause a non-cardiogenic capillary leak in the pulmonary vasculature. Okay, look, the picture that looks a lot like CHF. So what are the criteria for this? They have to have acute lung injury, meaning not something that they had before, but something that happened within 1 to 6 hours after the infusion. You have to have measured pulmonary occlusion pressure of less than 18 millimeters of mercury, and that's because you're trying to differentiate it between CHF, okay? Bilateral pulmonary infiltrates, and hypoxemia, okay? And this is important because it can lead to ARDS and has a 5 to 8% mortality. You also have symptoms of dyspnea, cough, and fever. Once again, sort of like the acute chest thing, but it is different. And risk factors are people with hematologic malignancies because they've also had a lot of transfusions probably, and those cells may not all be theirs. And cardiac disease as well, and people in the ICU tend to get it more than on the floors. So this is a picture of a patient with trolley. So you see it looks like bilateral pulmonary congestion in the upper radiograph. You see here an ET tube has been placed and clearing, and these pictures were taken 24 hours apart. So what would you do? What's the investigation for this? So if you suspect that there's trolley, you have to rule out cardiogenic pulmonary edema, right? Either by echocardiogram, chest x-ray, pulmonary catheterization is sometimes recommended to truly differentiate it. If possible, you take if they're going to be intubated, you take the pulmonary edema fluid from the trachea and you send it off for testing as well. One of the things they do is look for some of these anti-neutrophil antibodies in there. Once again, the blood bank will know what to do for this. And then they check the female donors for the granulocyte and HLA typing as well. And if the female donor is negative, they'll check any male donors as well. A lot of times our products are pooled products for plasma or cryoprecipitate. So what's our role besides being aware and excluding CHF? We have to treat them. We have to make the correct diagnosis. Counterintuitive to what you would do with someone with CHF, you actually give IV fluids over here. They may need intubation and mechanical ventilation. There's a question, since it is an immunologic response, whether we should give steroids or not. You can if you have a strong suspicion as well. And then supplemental oxygen. So in summary, for transfusion reactions, can be due to incompatibility, IgA deficiency, infectious causes, or minor antigen mismatches. Major transfusion reactions can lead to hypotension and shock, and prevention is aimed at minimizing unnecessary transfusions, as I mentioned, and eliminating clerical errors. Any questions about that before I go on to the next topic? Yes.
We recently started using single donor platelets.
Right.
So I want to ask why we have a better response, like we need less units than the traditional one that was supposed
to. Right. So that has to do with additional reasons than this. It's not necessarily for this reason. So when you have a single donor, it's only 4 units instead of 6 units, right? So they're able to extract more from that one donor than they are in a pooled bag of blood, okay? The estimated platelet response should be about 3,000 to 7,000 per unit in the bag. It's also confusing for ordering because, right? Yeah, you say one unit, they say one unit, but it's got 4, it's got 6, right? So I just say one bag or one dose platelet. So, and that's across different blood banks and different hospitals, and they keep changing, right? For a while it was, they said monodonor, the TRAP study, it was a study looked at monodonor versus mando, they said there was no difference in that, okay? But what they looked at in that study, which is one of the other things, is alloimmunization. So what is alloimmunization, right? You can only get so many lifetime transfusions of platelets before you become alloimmunized and you become, I want to say, allergic, or you become immune to that, whereas you will destroy those platelets and you won't have that increment of improvement with a transfusion. And that lifetime number is about 4 transfusions. Okay, so in our so we're very stingy in our oncologic patients who are going to get transfusions for chemotherapy. We have very strict criteria. It's got to be less than 10,000 or active bleeding. And the same should hold true for other medical patients as well. So, but the theory is with the monodonor is that you have less alloimmunization with those patients and less other immunologic reactions as well. The dose, though, the estimated increment should be the same with 6 versus 4. Okay. All right, TTP, the hematology fellow's favorite diagnosis, the one thing that will get them up at night to come in and look at the slide, right? We had a rule out TTP on July 1. They always come right away. So we need to know about this. It's also one of these things that it is life-threatening, but the treatment took the mortality from 10%, from 90% to 10%. So we can intervene and do a lot for these patients. So what is it? It's a and it used to be classified with HUS. Now we know it's a separate entity. And actually, Hun Wusai and Montefiore was one of the people that was the first one at Einstein to describe this. That it's a different mechanism. So it's a syndrome of target organ dysfunction where you basically have platelet activation and you have thrombosis, which is paradoxical to the low platelet count, and the microemboline to the end organs, including the brain, the kidneys, and so that's why you have the pentad, right? But you really have a dyad. You have microangiopathic hemolytic anemia and thrombocytopenia. Those are two things you need, okay? The fever, the mental status changes, the kidney function. You may or may not have that, but you need those two things. It's explained by an acquired or an inherited absence of von Willebrand factor cleaving protease, right? The Adams TS13 is the test that we do for this now. The test is nice to confirm later, but it takes a week. So you have to make a decision at the point of care, and then you can confirm it later on or not, okay? Most of the patients that we see are acquired, right? What's the one disease that we see that's associated with this a lot? HIV, so it's almost always in our HIV patients, but there's other patients that are not HIV as well, but an acquired deficiency of the cleaving protease is there a lot of times in HIV patients. I've never seen an inherited one, but the inherited deficiency of the cleaving protease is what proved the preclinical theory of this. So here's if you're more of a picture person than a word person, here's the picture of this. So you have the cleaving protease here. This is a normal person of one von Willebrand factor. And then you have, with TTP, you have these ULVWFs, unusually large von Willebrand factor cleaving proteases, where you're lacking the protease, and this large multimer is what causes platelet activation and thrombosis. So here's the TTP slide. So what do we see over here? The hint is the arrows. So what's this one over? What are these little things over here? Schistocytes, right. So so you see schistocytes, these are red blood cell fragments, okay? What's this big purplish cell over here? And by the way, if you come on hematology consults, right, you're going to learn to read slides. We look at all our patients' purple slides. What's that? Yeah, so it's a reticulocyte, right? So it's a larger cell. Sometimes you see basophilic stippling. It's the stage before the reticulocyte. But it's just one of the indicators, one of the things that we use to follow the disease. We're looking at LDH. We're looking at reticulocyte count as well to prove this. And we look at the smear to see how many schistocytes are and if the schistocytes are clearing as well. Now, I always say that not all that is microangiopathic is TTP, right? There's other causes of this, right? So there's traumatic from heart valves, Marks hemoglobinuria, right? That's the runner's anemia, they call that sometimes. Or congo or drum players sometimes get that actually as well. Infections, so malaria can do it, and sepsis, although malaria has a different look on the smear. Other causes of microangiopathic anemia are vasculitis, right? So anybody with connective tissue disease, something like malignant hypertension, right, can mimic almost everything with TTP. DIC and other microangiopathies, HELLP syndrome, and hemolytic uremic syndrome as well, and cancer-associated hemolytic uremic syndrome, sometimes associated with chemotherapy. So how do we treat these patients? So the important thing for you to know is that plasma exchange can save lives. There was a randomized controlled trial in Canada that looked at this. And in a pinch, if you can't get the a plasmapheresis, you can't get the catheter in, it at least will be solving half of the problem in that you will be giving the protease that is in normal plasma, which is lacking in the patient's plasma. Okay? The phreesis removes the unusually large von Willebrand factor multimers, so it's two things. Now, plasmapheresis is better than infusion. You don't give a platelet transfusion, why not? Because they can die, right? So you're adding fuel to fire. I mean, you are propagating this prothrombotic, even though the platelet count is low, you're propagating a hypercoagulable state by giving the platelets during infusion. Although there's been case reports that say, you know what, it's okay to give platelets, we gave it. And this is going to come up. You know why it's going to come up? Because you're going to have a patient with a platelet count that's low. You're going to ask vascular surgery or interventional or even yourself to put in a catheter. And they're going to say, well, the platelet count is low. We need to give platelets, right? So you can tell them, well, you don't want to give platelets because the data shows that actually that can make things worse. So we like to avoid platelet transfusion if possible. Now, one question that has come up in morning report is, what if the patient is bleeding? What if the patient is bleeding? Then what do you do? Trick question. Then it's not TTP. All right, then one of the other causes is something else. Although in severe cases you can have you can have some bleeding, but usually if it's not bleeding, remember this is a prothrombotic state, so they're not going to be bleeding oftentimes. If they are bleeding, then you know what that functionally tells you. Just like a patient with a cardiac disease or an MI, and they say, well, they have a low platelet count, can we give them Plavix or aspirin? And I say, well, they've shown that they're hypercoagulable, they just had an MI or they had a stroke, right? So the end result sort of tells you what you can do. So yeah, if they're bleeding, you can give them platelets. But if they're bleeding, they may not be, or probably not TTP. You probably have the wrong diagnosis. With refractory patients, we've given them steroids, antiplatelet drugs, occasional splenectomy, Rituxan is a chemotherapy agent, a monoclonal antibody against anti-CD20, used for a lot of immunologic conditions now, including refractory ITP, but it can also be used in some of these patients. We talked about this already. How does apheresis work? You're taking off the, you're adding protease by giving FFP, and you're taking off the either the inhibitor that's causing the protease, and you're also taking away the large multimers. Procedure is done daily. That's the other question we get. When can we stop? We usually don't stop daily until the platelet count becomes normal. That usually happens somewhere in the second week, and then you can taper them off afterwards. And then venous access, the practical question, what to do, what kind of access to give them. Should we give them a femoral line or a subclavian line? So there was this one article in JAMA that looked at the complication rates in thrombosis, in thrombosis infections and mechanical complications with femoral versus subclavian. And in that study, they found that femoral was worse across the board than subclavian line. You would think subclavian, higher risk of pneumothorax, but it didn't bear out in this study. The infection rate was 20% versus 5%, femoral versus subclavian. Bleeding risk was slightly higher, and thrombotic risk, actually, right? So we've seen it sometimes. DVTs after a femoral catheter, right? Well, was that from the catheter, or is that from something else? Then you have to put them on anticoagulation afterwards. So prefer lines elsewhere, but if you have to put it in the groin, you can then just change it later on. This was the schematic of that trial where they actually randomized the patients, and I just went over the results before showing you the schematic. These were the organisms that we saw in the patients. So in the femoral group, we had coag-negative staph, and this is, by the way, I mean, I don't know, it's there are at least quarterly, they want to know, because now Medicare wants to know how many catheter-related infections, right? And so that's one of the outcomes that they're looking at and that all hospitals now are focusing on. So these were the different bacteria. Sometimes it was gram-negative, those can kill you. Gram-positive, coag-negative staph being the most common. You know, for our patients, we are now looking at changing lines regularly for those patients. Most of our infections happen after day 10, so when we start approaching that, we change it, not over a guide wire, we change it with a new insertion site. And these are some of the complications of plasma exchange in patients with TTP, infections, thrombosis, and pneumothorax. Pneumothorax happening slightly more, just one patient actually in the subclavian approach versus the femoral approach. And this is a summary of those of that same data. 40% of patients had no complications. That means 60% had some kind of complication. So just we have to keep an eye on the patient. And a lot of times the patients are here for several weeks, so they're bound to get something. All right, that's TTP. Any questions about that? No? All right. It's getting hot. We're starting to drift off. I'm seeing some eyes closed. We'll try to get through those last five slides quickly. The last thing is DIC. So DIC can be confused with TTP sometimes. We see it more in the units. We can see it on the floors, though. It's characterized by dysregulation of thrombin. You can have a prothrombotic or bleeding phenotype for this. And you can have hemorrhage, thrombosis, multi-organ failure, both, not at the same time, though. These are the routine investigations we get, fibrinogen being the main one. Low fibrinogen makes you think of DIC. Fibrin degradation products, we don't really do those anymore, but D-dimers are similar. They're a breakdown product of DIC. That mostly helps if you have a patient with liver disease and you're wondering, is it low fibrinogen from consumption or is it from lack of production from the liver disease? So in a liver disease patient, D-dimer will be low along with the fibrinogen. In a DIC patient, it'll be high. These tests, the D-dimer is the most specific, fibrinogen is somewhere in the middle, and COAGs are not that specific for it. There are some other tests which every year I check with Dr. Aparoff, do we have these available? Not necessarily. We have protein C and protein S and antithrombin. We don't have the paracoagulation assays, but that's the most sensitive and specific. These are some of the causes of DIC. I just like to show this because, where is it? Viper venom bites, right? We had a case actually last year when I gave this talk. We actually had a patient, inpatient, because this is, as you know, a regional snake bite center, along with being a trauma center where a snake bite center is. We actually had a patient with DIC last year with a snake bite. So, head injuries were also a trauma center. Why would head injuries cause that? Tissue factors released with brain injury, there's lots of tissue factor in the brain, and so that starts the coagulation cascade. And then you have different cancers can do it. The thing that we see most is infection as medicine people, but remember also hypotension can also do it as well. And then obstetrics, we also have a very active high-risk obstetrics unit. The pathogenesis, we have depletion of the hemostatic factors from hyperfibrinogenemia. We have depletion of inhibitors sometimes. Alpha-2 antiplasmin can be inhibited, and also depletion of antithrombin and protein C and protein S. So these are things that we can measure that are available here. There's heterogeneous triggers. Some specialized things that we should look for. So for a patient that we think has DIC from placental abruption, we would treat with cryoprecipitate. Why cryoprecipitate and not FFP? Cryoprecipitate has its... What is cryoprecipitate? What's in cryoprecipitate? How do they get cryoprecipitate, right? So we give blood. There's five things that we can get from that, right? Five products that we get out of that, right? White blood cells, not used very often, right? That's they don't last very long. That's one of the reasons, right? And you have to have HLA matched person. We've given it a couple times in 10 years here. Red cells, we know that, right? And then you donate, they freeze off the plasma, and they freeze off the platelets. Now, within the plasma, right, when they freeze it, the stuff that rises to the top, right, that's why it's called cryoprecipitate, is the cryo. So the cryoprecipitate has factor 8, factor 9, factor 13, and fibrinogen. Right? So for patients with low fibrinogen, we like to give cryoprecipitate. Patients with prostate CA will sometimes have a spontaneous DIC as well. Bleeding patients, aminocaproic acid, we give it by continuous infusion. an acute promyelocytic leukemia. It's a board question, not just for the heme boards and onc boards, but for the medicine boards as well. They get a DIC as well, and the treatment for that is all transretinoic acid. So just keep that in mind. Adenocarcinoma, avoid warfarin sometimes. They can have a paradoxical worsening of the thrombosis, Trousseau syndrome. Giving them heparin if they have a chronic DIC. Septicemia with acral gangrene. Sometimes you can give the combinated activated protein C. I think it's only been given twice at this place. I'm not sure if it's very expensive. There was an improvement in survival in the one randomized study leading to its approval. HIT, just differentiate that from DIC. Usually they don't have a low fibrinogen. They have normal PTPTT, unlike DIC, which has a high PTPTT. So just my last slide is about the activated protein C concentrate. I mean, we've been given a lot of these other factors now for bleeding patients. We're given ANOVA 7, which is an activated factor 7. And for something with hemophilia, we're giving factor 8. But activated protein C, this is a randomized trial of patients with sepsis, DIC, and the ICU, 2,000 patients. They basically saw an overall risk of death reduction of 6%, relative risk reduction of 20%. There was more bleeding in the APCC versus the non-APCC group as well. So in summary, last two slides. Sickle cell patients, acute chest syndrome, red cell exchange transfusion, or simple transfusion can save their lives, so just be aware of it. Transfusion reactions can be from infections, incompatibility, minor antigen mismatches, clavicularyl still being number one. Trolley, just make sure it's not CHF. TTP, don't give platelets. Be aware of the diagnosis. Be aware of the dyad, microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, and thrombocytopenia. And plasmapheresis stream of choice, but you can give plasma infusion in a pinch. And DIC can be bleeding or thrombosis, just differentiated from HIT, DIC, and other causes. And that's it. Any questions? Thank you for staying without lunch.
Just echo. Yeah. What's that? Yeah. Oh, that's all I need to.
Can I have this?
Oh, yeah. You want it? Sure. I think I saved it last year here, but you want to put your disc in?
Yeah, we should have it.
Yeah. How do you get to all the talks? I mean, is there like a drive that everybody gets to? Because I saved it last year. I changed one slide this year. I didn't get a chance.
They should have saved it.
Yeah, I mean, here, you want me to, I can email it to you if you want. What's your email address? Okay, fine. Yeah. There you go. Your chief has it. Yes. How are you? Good. How's it going?
I'm hanging in there pretty well.
Yeah?
I was wondering if you can give me the email of the individual that...